You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The competition between the United States and China is one of the biggest stories of our time. Although the two countries are rivals for geopolitical power, the situation is complicated because China is the United States' second-largest trading partner and its largest foreign creditor. Eric J. Dolan has traced the trade relationship between the two superpowers back to its origins in his latest book called When America First Met China. It's from Liverite Publishing, an imprint of W.W. Norton. And I'm very pleased that it brings Eric J. Dolan back to our show. Hello.
Hello.
In your book, you point out that there was a trade imbalance between the U.S. and China from the very start, dating back to just after the United States achieved its independence from Britain. What led to it then?
Well, it was basically that the Chinese were not that interested in Western goods, including the goods that the Americans could bring there. And for many, many years, before the Americans even got involved in the China trade, other countries, such as Britain, which was China's largest trading partner, had to bring in enormous quantities of Spanish silver, predominantly pieces of eight, the first truly global currency, in order to satisfy the Chinese merchants and purchase the tea, silk, and porcelain that the British and then the Americans demanded.
And was this because the Chinese felt that they could be self-sufficient, that they didn't need anything from anywhere else?
That's often how outsiders perceived it, but they themselves were not quite self-sufficient. They had a huge trading network in Asia, and a lot of fundamental goods were brought in from other countries. But in terms of Western manufacturers, there was just not that much interest. But even more than that, it was that the Chinese greatly valued silver. They used it to pay their military. The people used it to pay their taxes. So it was treasure that the Chinese really wanted.
And then we'll get into this later. The United States did find something that they wanted, and that was fur.
Fur, yes. The Americans first started bringing sea otter pelts to Canton, China, in the late 1700s. And bear in mind that these pelts were greatly desired by the Chinese, who had been getting them earlier from the Japanese and the Russians. A prime sea otter pelt could get a price of $100 in Canton. And this is a time at which the average American merchant was earning perhaps $1 to $2 a day. So it was a great bounty.
What did they want to do with the sea otter pelts?
Oh, they would stitch them into garments and wear them, especially in northern China, where the capital was, because it was very cold.
And that led to the near extinction of sea otters off of what is now California.
California.
And then later Hawaii and Fiji.
Yeah, the Pacific Northwest coast in California, the extreme demand for these pelts, and there was a limited population of sea otters to begin with. There were dozens and dozens of American and other ships killing these sea otters for decades. And yes, that is part of the reason that today they are endangered or threatened species.
And did your interest in this story grow out of your last book, which was about furs?
Yeah, to a large extent. One of the big chapters in Fur, Fortune, and Empire was about this burgeoning sea otter pelt trade with China that by the early 1800s became nearly an American monopoly.
So some of the names that we associate with that time, like Astor, were involved in this trade?
Absolutely. Astor, who came over from Germany, landed in New York in 1784, made a fortune in the fur trade. And by the late 1700s and early 1800s, he was sending ships around Cape Horn to gather those sea otter pelts and then taking them on to Canton. And interestingly enough, he used his fur trading fortune to invest in New York real estate at a time when his friends were making fun of him for buying swampland in New York. That swampland later turned out to be what we know as Times Square today. So he was the one that was laughing all the way to the bank.
Well, some people would still call it a swamp, but that's a whole other matter. Long before the United States began trading with China, the Chinese government had controlled foreign trade by forcing all foreign ships to dock at one single port in Canton, now Guangzhou.
Yes.
By the time the U.S. began trading with them, hadn't the Chinese already been trading with Europe for 2,000 years?
Yes, I mean, via the Silk Road.
And the Middle East as well.
And the Middle East. Oh, yeah. The Chinese were not as closed off of a society or empire as many people suspected. They had active trading networks throughout Asia and beyond to the West.
Which Chinese goods were most prized by European traders?
Oh, tea was far and away the number one good from a very early time, but also silk and porcelain, lacquer, furniture, later on paintings, and all sorts of crafts.
And even rhubarb, which they used as a laxative.
Yeah, rhubarb was fascinating. The Chinese actually believed that without their rhubarb, Westerners would die from severe constipation.
Now, the first American boat to sail for China was the Empress of China, which left New York in February 1784. Had Americans had any access to Chinese imports in the years before we became independent from Britain?
Yeah, the Americans had long had a love affair with things Chinese. From the mid-1600s up until the eve of the Revolution, the British East India Company primarily had brought many exotic Chinese items to America's shores. So there was a huge market in the colonies. In fact, right before the American Revolution, Americans drank more than 1 billion cups of tea annually.
And they were only coming from China?
Yes, the tea was only coming from China.
And of course, we know about the Tea Party.
The Tea Party, yeah. Well, that was partly because of Americans' anger over the British East India Company's monopoly and anger over increased taxes on tea.
What cargo did the Empress of China carry to sell to the Chinese?
It brought alcohol, lead, furs. But the two most important items that were on board were the $20,000 in Spanish silver coins and 30 tons of ginseng.
So they... 30 tons of ginseng.
That's ginseng.
Great. They were bringing ginseng to China?
Absolutely. The Chinese had a species of ginseng, Panax ginseng, that grows in the northern areas of China for, you know, forever. They'd been harvesting that. But the Americans discovered, though they didn't discover, the French actually discovered it first, but the Americans took advantage of another species of ginseng, Panax quinquefolius, which could be found in North America. And they dug it up at a rapid rate.
So this is pretty clever. They were actually bringing stuff to the Chinese that the Chinese want.
Yes.
They had done their research.
Yes.
And they went with a French escort.
Yes. By the time the Empress of China made it to Java, they were entering the South China Sea, which is a very dangerous area because at that time there were something like 80,000 Chinese pirates infesting the waters. And they also didn't have very good charts at the time, but they met some French ships that had been to China many times before, and they escorted the Americans to Canton.
This is around the time of the French Revolution, no?
A little bit before. It was right after. I mean, this was a great meeting because keep in mind that the French had helped us immensely beat the British during the American Revolution.
So the British and the French had a real presence in China. Were they happy to see the Americans arrive?
At first, yes, and the British welcomed them in open arms and actually said, if Britain and America, let's forget about that recent unpleasantness that was the American Revolution. If we could combine forces, we could rule the world of trade. But what rapidly happened is the Americans turned out to be very good competitors.
And you pointed out that the Chinese referred to Europeans as foreign devils and barbarians, but they had a different name for the Americans.
Well, each foreign country got their own foreign devil appellation. The British were called the red-haired devils. And when the Americans arrived, they thought they were British initially, but they were later told that that wasn't the case. And they finally ended up calling the Americans the flowery flag devils because our flag, the white stars on a blue background, looked like flowers in a field.
Were they happier to trade with us because the British did all their trading through the British East India Company and Americans didn't have any kind of system like that?
Right. Yeah, the Chinese were favorably disposed towards the Americans as trading partners, but they had a long-established relation with the British East India Company. It was really the British East India Company and the British who got so annoyed with the Americans' free form of trade, and in fact, that's what led Parliament to take away the British East India Company's monopoly because the Americans were beating them at their own game.
And the U.S. government got involved as well, didn't it?
Right. Well, the U.S. government was only involved to a limited extent
by levying taxes.
Right. They gave them some benefits, tax breaks, to encourage the infant industry.
My guest is Eric J. Dolan. His latest book is When America First Met China. It is published by Live Right. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Eric J. Dolan, who is the best-selling author of the award-winning Fur, Fortune, and Empire, Also, Leviathan, which was chosen by the Los Angeles Times and Boston Globe as a best book of the year. His latest is called When America First Met China, an exotic history of tea, drugs, and money in the age of sail. The book is published by LiveRight. There's been a lot of discussion during this current presidential campaign about Chinese currency manipulation and unfair trading practices. Were they also factors in the early days of trading between Americans and the Chinese?
No, not really. The Americans were basically independent actors that went over there without much support from the government, and there wasn't much discussion stateside about Chinese practices other than them being too restrictive.
But there were trade imbalances. Americans thought that you have this huge, just as they do today, you have this huge population, a limitless market for their goods, but that never materialized.
From that angle, yes, the Americans had looked at China, which had hundreds of millions of people, as a almost limitless potential market for their goods. But they were frustrated continuously by having to bring in silver and then also these forms of credit, bills on London to pay for their goods. And they said, if only the Chinese would buy more of our goods, the trade would really take off.
And we did have things, I'm sure, that they wanted other than otter pelts and and sandalwood is another thing that they wanted.
Sandalwood. Yeah, there was bechamel, there was sea cucumbers, ginseng.
Sea cucumbers, I've always associated them with China. They are American?
No, they're not American. The Americans picked them up in Fiji and Hawaii and the Marquesas, and the Chinese had long used sea cucumbers to flavor soup.
The British, who had been trading with China long before the United States achieved independence, had run up a huge trade deficit of their own long before that first American trading ship arrived in China. So is that why the British started selling opium to the Chinese to redress that imbalance?
Yes, they were long looking for something to replace this hemorrhaging of silver that was taking place. And by the late 1700s, they started bringing in more and more opium, which was illegal in China. But as more Chinese smoked the drug, the demand rose. The smugglers paid for the opium in silver. So the British got the silver that they needed to turn around and buy Chinese goods.
The British also started doing knockoffs, didn't they? Wedgwood is a less expensive alternative to Chinese porcelain.
Absolutely.
So what about the United States and the opium trade? Although it's less well known, didn't American traders also import opium into China?
Yes. They did it at a much lower level than the British, but they still made a considerable amount of money. There are a lot of American fortunes that came from opium trading, whereas the British in the 1830s would be bringing in 30,000 chests. The Americans might bring in 1,000 to 1,500 chests of opium.
And one of those opium dealers was a man named Delano, in Franklin Delano Roosevelt?
Yes, that's his descendant. FDR has a history, a family history of involvement in making quite a fortune in the opium trade.
You pointed out that in addition to furs, the Chinese were very interested in buying sandalwood from the American traders. Why was sandalwood so desirable? What did they use it for?
Well, sandalwood has a fragrant oil within it, and the wood was prized in China to be carved into aromatic furniture and also be made into incense that was burned in houses of worship.
And from your descriptions, it seems that the early traders harvested sandalwood almost as irresponsibly as they had harvested the seal furs. Where did most of the sandalwood come from?
Most of it came from Fiji, Hawaii, and then the Marquesas. And you're absolutely right. It was a tragedy of the commons. This demand, basically the reckless clear-cutting of sandalwood, destroyed those forests.
So there's no sandalwood in those
places? No, there still is, but you don't find large sandalwood groves anymore.
I was interested to note that the latest book from Mo Yan, the Chinese winner of this year's Nobel Prize for Literature, is called Sandalwood Death.
It'd be interesting to see what it's about.
One really funny anecdote that you include in this book involves Chinese artists in Canton duplicating paintings that have been created by American artists. Copies made in China of Gilbert Stuart's painting of George Washington, known as the Athenaeum Portrait, actually resulted in a court case, didn't it?
Yeah, Gilbert Stuart, whenever he sold one of his paintings, and he made many copies of this, he had a codicil in the agreement that you would not reproduce this. But some American captains brought his paintings to China, where they're very excellent painters who could reproduce these reverse paintings on glass. And finally, Gilbert Stuart got so upset, he brought one of the captains, John Swords, to court, and he was ordered to desist. but perhaps as many as 100 of these duplicates were made.
And then Americans started bringing other things to China to have them duplicated.
Right. The Carnes brothers here in New York City decided that all these French perfumes and other items could be reproduced in China for less cost. And they were. And they made – those were the first sort of Chinese real knockoffs that came to New York in the 1830s.
Do you think that that has led to that industry today? Because it's pretty big in China.
Well, there's certainly an ancestral connection, whether it was a direct link. But the Chinese from the very beginning showed a great facility for copying things.
Well, during the late 1790s, early 1800s, hundreds of ships sailed between the United States and China. But trade accounted for only a tiny portion of the U.S.'s foreign trade.
Right. It was only about 4 to 5%.
Who were we trading mostly with?
Europe. I mean, England, again, became one of our biggest trading partners, and the other countries in Europe. And there was also South America, a very large South American trade, Brazil. So even though the China trade was relatively small, it was very important to our infant country as a sort of jump start.
Especially since for a time we lost Britain as a trading partner.
Right. It was one of the avenues that was open to us after the American Revolution.
So what happened with the American involvement in the opium trade? Was the government as in support of it as the British government had been?
No, the American government was not directly involved in the opium trade like the British government was, in part because it was a smaller part of the overall trade. The Americans were sort of free riders. They were going along making fortunes, selling opium. They weren't directly involved in either of the opium wars, but they greatly benefited from them because it opened up China to more trade.
And mostly our involvement was the ships bringing the opium in?
Right, yes. We would both bring opium in that we purchased at auctions in India, and earlier we brought it from Turkey. And also Americans often act as transporters for the British, bringing the opium to China.
From India?
From India. India was the place where the best opium by Chinese standards came from.
How were the Chinese finally able to clamp down on the opium smuggling?
Well, they weren't very successful. In late 1839, they decided to really clamp down by basically imprisoning all the Westerners in this 12-acre area of Canton and forcing them to hand over tens of thousands of chests of opium. They destroyed 20,000 chests of opium, but that precipitated the first opium war. Britain had a long history with China, and they basically wanted to open up this closed country to more trade, and they used the imprisonment of their merchants and other things that happened at this time as a pretense or an excuse for sending an armed fleet to China and then drubbing the Chinese in the Opium War and resulting in a treaty that didn't say anything at all about opium. And opium continued to flow into the country until the Second Opium War in the late 1850s, after which opium importation was legalized.
You said earlier that the Russians had sold furs to the Chinese before the Americans arrived. Were they selling seal and sea otter pelts, or were they selling something else?
No, the Russians were very involved in seal trade, in sea otter pelt trade.
So were the Americans just offering a better deal, or were the furs of higher quality?
No, they weren't necessarily.
Were the Russians upset that we were suddenly competing with them for this lucrative market?
Yes, the Russians who had had a base in Alaska, yes, they were upset by the infiltration of these Americans along the Pacific Northwest coast. But the Americans were exceptionally adept at trading, and they also sent a huge number of ships, and they just rapidly cornered the market. Sometimes they partnered with Russians. Down in California, there were Russians would hire American ships, and they would split the proceeds.
This is your 11th book?
Yes.
All nonfiction?
All nonfiction.
I mentioned that you were here 5 years ago to talk about Leviathan, the history of whaling in America, which was a bestseller. And then came Fur, Fortune and Empire. Do all of the – does one book just lead to another? Because we try to exterminate the whales.
Yes.
We did a pretty good job with the sea otters, although yes, a few still survive.
Yeah, it did, in fact, because in Fur, Fortune, Empire, that's what exposed me first to the China-American trade through the sea otter pelt trade. So there was a connection.
And the sea otters were pretty easy to catch because they were fairly the populations of seals and sea otters had never seen people before the humans arrived.
Yeah.
So they didn't see us as natural enemies.
Well, the sea otters, the Americans didn't do the capturing. Those were the natives along the West Coast, and they were very adept at using their bidarkas or kayaks to surround and then kill the sea otters. With seals, yes, we went to rookeries where they'd never seen humans before, and they basically would club the seals to death, and it was a very easy process, and that's part of the reason why the seal populations were decimated worldwide.
Some of that still happens today. I've
sure,
seen films.
Sure, absolutely.
I understand you're already at work on your 12th book. Is it related to the way we traded with China?
No, it's a total departure. I'm working on sort of a portrait of Boston in antebellum America before the Civil War and how it coped with the issue of slavery through some very high-profile cases that took place.
Well, this book was chosen by Kirkus as one of the 10 best nonfiction books of 2012. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And the book is called When America First Met China, An Exotic History of Tea, Drugs, and Money in the Age of Sail. It is published by Live Right, which is an imprint of W.W. Norton. My great thanks to you for being on our show again.
Thank you.